Case number 19-5310, Margaret B. Cuoca, appellant versus Internal Revenue Service. Ms. Rosenbaum for the appellant, Ms. Lyon for the appellee.
May it please the court, Adina Rosenbaum on behalf of plaintiff appellant Margaret Cuoca. Margaret Cuoca is a law professor whose scholarly research focuses on government transparency and federal agencies' administration of the Freedom of Information Act. As part of her research, she filed a FOIA request with the IRS seeking copies of their FOIA logs, including the names of third-party FOIA requesters and the organizational affiliations of FOIA requesters, which the IRS withheld. On cross motions for summary judgment, the district court rejected all of the IRS's arguments for its blanket withholding of these records, saying that the agency's reasoning suffered from logical problems. The court required the agency to release the records subject only to limited redactions that the agency had to specifically justify, and the IRS subsequently released the vast majority of the records, which was thousands of names and organizational affiliations. Nonetheless, when Professor Cuoca moved for an award of attorney's fees, the district court denied her motion, concluding that although she was eligible for fees, she was not entitled to fees under the four-factor test that this court uses to determine entitlement. In so concluding, the district court abused its discretion in two ways. First, it abused its discretion in weighing against Professor Cuoca the second and third entitlement factors, which look at the requester's commercial interest in the records and the nature of the plaintiff's interest in the records. And second, it abused its discretion in weighing against her the fourth entitlement factor, which looks at the reasonableness of the agency's initial withholding.
On the second and third factors, I wasn't sure where the district court was landing. Can you help me understand? It certainly didn't seem helpful to Ms. Cuoca. Is it the nature of interest is both professional and pecuniary? You're reading that as a resolution of both those prongs against Ms. Cuoca?
Yes, I think the only way to read this sentence is that it weighed both of the prongs against her. It addresses both of the prongs, and the prongs all often are considered together. It addresses both of them in one sentence that it begins with but. So in talking about the first factor, says that she has met that first factor, or indicates that first factor weighs in her favor. And then it says but to introduce the other two factors. So I think the only way to read the sentence is that it has weighed both the second and third factors against her.
And that quoted language from Cotton, I guess she called her Heyman, was language resolving a prong against?
No, that language from Cotton, Cotton didn't actually turn on the second and third. That's just sort of the language of the standard.
Okay.
So it's quoting the standard in doing that. On the second and third.
Mr. Roosevelt, let me ask you about the fourth factor. So this is, given that this is a judge who granted summary judgment to plaintiffs. In other words, on the underlying case, she ruled for the plaintiffs. Yet she concluded that the IRS's defense was not unreasonable. So given that, and given what we've called our double dose of deference here, how do we conclude that she abused her discretion in that? Reaching that conclusion?
I think the court abused its discretion by looking at the wrong factors, in particular in saying that the IRS had a reasonable basis ex ante in withholding the records. The court stated that its primary motivation was to ensure that it was not disclosing confidential tax return information. But the question for the fourth entitlement factor isn't about the agency's subjective motivation, whether it had good faith to withhold the records. It's about whether it had a reasonable basis in law for withholding the records. And when the court addressed the legal basis for withholding the records in its summary judgment decision, it found that the agency's reasoning suffered from logical problems, that the agency's conclusions did not follow from its premises.
You just broke up. Could you just say that sentence once again?
Sure.
So the question, the last word I heard was logical.
Sorry about that. So the agency...
That's not your fault. Yeah.
In its summary judgment decision, the court concluded that the agency's reasoning suffered from logical problems, that its conclusions did not...
Correct.
Did not follow from its premises. So when the court...
But notwithstanding that, she concluded that the agency's position in the underlying litigation was not unreasonable.
Right, but in doing that, she looked at the wrong considerations, particularly at the motivation, the subjective motivation.
But she went on to say that the position was substantively reasonable. She didn't rest only on good motive.
Well, the other thing that the court pointed to in saying that it was reasonable was that the redactions showed that there had been some legitimate cause for concern. But that looking at the redactions also involves examining the wrong factor, because the question isn't whether there was a reasonable basis for withholding the records that the agency ultimately withheld. And Professor Cuoca did not object to those redactions. She did not challenge those redactions when the agency made them. The question is whether the agency had a good faith basis, reasonable basis in law to withhold all of the records that it withheld at the beginning, including all of the ones that it eventually released in the case. So we think that in determining that she had that the agency had a reasonable basis as an ex ante, that the court was examining the wrong considerations and not looking at whether the agency had a reasonable basis in law for withholding all of the records that it originally withheld. And what
is the ex ante point in time that we're talking about is the initial decision for blanket withholding?
Yes. So the question is whether it had a reasonable basis to withhold
at that time, to do a blanket withholding.
To do a blanket withholding at the beginning of the case.
To not determine whether it could segregate portions out.
Right, whether it had a reasonable basis for not complying with its obligations to segregate out the non-exempt
records. And as to that, its reasons were new document, which the district court flatly rejected.
Yes.
And administrative burden, which the district court flatly rejected.
Yes.
So that's what we're comparing, looking at right now, is a blank, the justification, whether the blanket withholding on those two grounds was reasonable.
Whether there is a reasonable basis for the blanket withholding overall. Yes.
Right. Okay. Those two grounds. And then the concern was there might be something in here some things in here that will disclose stuff covered by 6103. And we're not going to look any further because new record administrative burden.
Well, the agency overall did not engage in any segregation. It was not willing to
segregate. Because of the administrative burden and new document arguments.
Yes. I would like to briefly touch on the second and third entitlement factors as well. The court abused its discretion with regards to those factors by failing to apply this court's decision in Davey and ignoring Professor Cuoca's scholarly interest in the records. In Davey, this court made clear that scholars were precisely the type of requesters that the FOIA's attorney's fee provision is for, and that generally the second and third factors should weigh in favor of scholars, of people with a scholarly interest in the records, unless they have a purely commercial interest or their request is frivolous. Here, Professor Cuoca's interest was clearly scholarly. She sought this information to use in her forthcoming book and in other scholarly works. Her interests were not purely commercial or frivolous, and those two factors should have weighed in her favor. She is the paradigmatic scholar seeking information for public information purposes.
There's a third possibility on factors 2 and 3. They could be resolved in a in the requester's favor, they could be resolved in the government's favor, or they just might not cut one way or the other. And you cite Davey, which is a very good case for you, no doubt about it. But post Davey, we have McKinley, which says that when you have a requester with both motives, the commercial and the scholarly, it's not an abuse of discretion to conclude that that factor falls in the middle category. It doesn't cut one way or the other, right? So why shouldn't we understand the district court basically to have been acting consistently with McKinley rather than inconsistently with Davey?
I think the only way to read what the district court did was to weigh those two factors actually against Professor Cuoca.
Factor one, she resolved in your favor. And then there's the but.
There's the but, and the but, only and thing
the but,
that...
The but means she's not resolving factors two and three in your favor. But where do you get that she's resolved, she's counting them against you, which would be a Davey error, as opposed to just saying, I'm not counting them one way or the other, which would be fine under McKinley.
I think that the but does indicate that it's saying something opposing, and then the fourth factor is introduced with moreover. So I think that the structure of the decision makes clear that she's weighing the first factor in favor of Professor Cuoca, and then the last three factors against Professor Cuoca. I think also looking at what the court took into account on the second factor.
Just back up there too. McKinley, the requester, was someone in business for himself as a regulatory policy expert, not an academic, with no real history of academic publications. So do you read McKinley as changing Davey to say that when you're an academic and you're also publishing a book, it's a draw on two and three? I hadn't read McKinley that way.
I don't think that McKinley changes overrides Davey in that way. And I think on
it didn't involve an academic, and we talked a lot about academics, because otherwise I don't know why a newspaper reporter was writing a book say about bringing down Harvey Weinstein or Jeffrey Epstein or something, and because that was federal government, did a FOIA request for that.
I mean, I think here there's just no basis for finding that Professor Cuoca's commercial interests outweigh her scholarly interests. And the district court, again, did not take her scholarly interests into account at all. It only talks about her commercial interest, her pecuniary interest, her professional interest. There's no recognition that she was seeking this information for public informational purposes, which is the way in which scholars seek information. So it ignored her scholarly interests overall. There is no basis here for finding that her commercial interests, and the only possible thing that the court could have been referring to in talking about her commercial interests is the fact that she earns her living as a scholar and is publishing a book, an academic book about FOIA. But in Davey, this court recognized-
Books like that make much money?
I would not expect that book to make a lot of money for
your client.
Under your theory though, does that really make any difference?
I don't think it makes a difference how much money the book will make. I think at the extremes, there could be if it becomes clear someone is really publishing a book solely for private pecuniary.
No, but I was asking you the question about her, a scholar, a university-based scholar.
Right, professor.
Does it make a difference? Does it make a difference? Are scholars who write books like this treated differently from scholars who write Econ 101 that's used by every freshman in the United States?
I don't think it makes a difference. I think if the purpose of the book is scholarly and it's being written for an academic purpose to be increasing the public knowledge, then the amount of money that the professor is making doesn't make a difference. That's just how.
Okay. Okay, great, thank you. Unless either of my colleagues have any questions, you're out of time.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Nope.
Okay, we'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Kathleen Lyon and I represent the IRS. The district court here properly exercised its broad discretion in denying Professor Cuoca's request for attorney's fees because, first and foremost, the IRS had a reasonable or at least a colorable basis in law for withholding the documents, principally to ensure compliance.
What supports your statement in your brief that that's the most important factor? Don't you say the fourth factor is the most important?
Yeah, we say it's the most important here. We think because we think that.
Oh, you mean here?
Yes, yes. We're not saying that the fourth factor is elevated above.
And
other
why
factors.
Is it the most? Oh.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up.
Oh, so you think it's just the most important? You think it's just the most important in this case?
Correct.
And why is that?
Because we think that factor standing alone would be sufficient to affirm in this case. For example, under Morley 3, this court found that even though factors 1 through 3 weighed in favor of the FOIA requester, the plaintiff in that case, that factor 4 was enough in that case because it weighed strongly enough to support affirming the court's denial of the award of fees. And we think this is a similar situation, that even if, you know, the first three factors weighed in Professor Cuoco's favor, that the district court's finding that, or determination that, yes.
Here's my question about this factor. So you devote several pages in your brief to the proposition that the service was motivated to protect confidential return information. That's what its motivation was here. And of course, that's true. I mean, no one would disagree with that. But the question we have to ask is, why was it reasonable to think that this particular FOIA request, this one, would result in the release of return information? That's the question. And I didn't see anywhere in your brief where you responded to that.
Well, I think what we've...
The district court in her summary judgment motion said that basically the IRS's position on that issue didn't make any sense.
Well, the district court found that there were logical problems with that argument. However, the district court is very familiar with its own opinion, and it found even despite that the district...
Yeah, I know that, but we still have to review it. We have to review it. I asked counsel for that same question. You're right. It is significant that this is the same district judge who granted summary judgment for the plaintiffs, but we still have to ask whether it was an abuse of discretion. And my question to you is that I didn't see in your brief anywhere where you explained that why it was at all reasonable to think that this particular FOIA request would result in the release of return information.
Well,
that's what I don't see. I mean, go ahead.
I'm sorry, okay. Our brief pages 28 and 29, I believe, we set out that the question that was posed by this FOIA request was a novel legal question about which there wasn't any specific guidance. There wasn't any precedent. There wasn't any, specific exclusion in 6103 that would answer the question of whether third-party FOIA requesters and the organizational affiliations of FOIA requesters would, when combined with the subject matter of the FOIA request, result in an indirect disclosure of return information. And so it was a novel question that arose in a familiar framework of 6103. And of course, 6103 has these extremely broad definitions of return information, and disclosure. And it's established that that when information is aggregated with other information, if that poses a great risk of disclosure of return information, that also is prohibited. Now, the FOIA law...
What about this case? What about this FOIA request? I mean, they rejected it. They didn't offer any to turn over some of it with redactions as a blanket rejection.
Correct.
And the question is, why was it reasonable for the IRS to think that this request would result in the disclosure of return information? Why was that at all reasonable given everything the district court said?
Well, if I could step back for a moment and perhaps give a big picture look here. Now, of course, the FOIA log itself is not 6103. You know, it wouldn't be a public FOIA log if it were. But the vast majority of FOIA requests that come to the IRS are asking for return information for very common sense reasons, because people generally don't ask the IRS for documents that don't exist or for documents.
I'm sorry, when you say the vast majority, the Roe Declaration said you get many requests for that and you get, quote, many, quote, requests for non-return information. Are you disagreeing that with that declaration now when you say the vast majority seek tax information?
I don't think it's incorrect to say that there are many requests that are for non-return information, but those can be split between
the vast majority when there's many for non-return information. And this one included a request for non-return information, as well as your concern about return information.
Well, it asked for the names of organizational affiliations. It didn't necessarily distinguish.
Those FOIA requests that were for non-tax information.
Well, correct. But the problem for the IRS is that looking at when Professor Cuoco's request comes in, suddenly she wants to associate names with everything on the FOIA log. And the automated system, of course, can produce a list of names of the requesters and their organizational affiliations. But the IRS can't release that list without risking violating 6103 because there's no way to distinguish.
Well, I want to hang on. I'm sorry.
That's our question. Why? You keep saying that, but why?
Well, because the automated system has no way of distinguishing between what's a first party request, what's a third party request, what's a request for tax information or tax return information, what's a request for non-return information. And so we think that, you know, given the broad definitions in 6103, the IRS has to make a judgment call about the risk of 6103 violations. And this was a very novel and complex request. And so the IRS's concern there was reasonable, or at least a colorable basis in law. The fact is that
I just want to be crystal clear here.
Yes.
Roe's declaration said you get many requests for non-return information. And this was just for a year, 2015. So there's no reason to think 2015 would have been different than other years. It would have included many FOIA requests for tax return information and many for non-return tax information. Right. And then Roe's declaration specifically said,
yes,
disclosing the requester names and organizational affiliations with respect to those requests for non-tax records would not reveal tax information under 6103. Mm-hmm. And 6103 itself, you got to read the whole thing, says that its protection does not include data in a form which cannot be associated with or otherwise identified directly or indirectly a particular taxpayer, which is exactly what your declarant, Mr. Rose, said. We would have had many of those in 2015, correct? You don't disagree with your own declarant, right?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that, you know, all of that can be true, but the IRS...
Maybe you had a lot in there that wasn't protected by 6103. You thought there might be some that if things got pieced together, or you worried, I guess there were some, and that's conscientious.
You're worried that there were a lot,
close to a lot, but you didn't know. You didn't know.
Right.
You didn't take any inquiry.
Well, the IRS couldn't tell based on the
It couldn't
the
tell without looking. That's what Mr. Rowe said.
Correct. They couldn't, and we also argued, of course, the unreasonable burden.
Right, and the district court flatly rejected that as not a reasonable argument.
Well, it did that based in part on Public Citizen, in which case...
I'm not asking what cases they cited. The district court just found no merit to that argument at all.
Well, correct, but it didn't find that was, you know, the district court here didn't find that that would have been an unreasonable basis for our argument. It just said that the IRS was wrong. And, you know, there are distinctions between Public Citizen and our case here, specifically that the reason that
the... This is the case about you had a concern that there might be some in there. I didn't see in your any declaration that said you were concerned that lots and lots would be in there, but you were concerned that there would be some in there in 6103's
correct
important statute. And then, as I read the process, what happened is then what the government said is, and we're not going to look and check to see, because it would be too much work.
because the
all the documents. It would just be too much work to look. That was the position.
Yes, that it would be an unreasonable burden.
It wasn't that we know there, that we think there's lots. There's no declarant I saw that said we think there's lots in there that are protected by 6103. I didn't see that quantification. If I'm erroneous, please tell me. It's just that it could be one, could be 200. We have no idea.
Correct.
We know there's a chunk in there that don't really won't release tax return information.
There's some that may not, yes.
We know many will not include tax return information, according to Mr. Rowe's words. But we're not looking. And so isn't that what we're deciding, whether the district court was correct to decide that position was colorable under FOIA?
Well, I think the colorable bar is a fairly low bar. considering—
We're not gonna bother looking?
No, Your Honor. We made a reasonable—
That's exactly what Mr. Rowe said. We're not going to look. It would be too much work.
Correct, and it is perfectly legitimate for the—
After summary judgment, and it turns out it didn't.
Correct, it turns out it didn't, but the reasonableness factor is determined, you know, earlier in that process, at the time the IRS is making the decision. And in light of the fact that—
There's something when Mr. Rowe described why it would take a lot of work that he was wrong about, because he just said how many documents and how many hours.
Yes, and our other declarant, Corinna Smith, also laid out the number of hours and why it would take that long.
Okay, so were they just wrong about that? It looks like it took a decent amount of time. It took, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 months, something like that. Maybe it was.
Yeah, well, there was also the government shutdown in there. That was the 5-week shutdown. And so it did take a good deal of time to do it. And Corinna Smith, I think in particular, in her declaration, laid out why that was going to be the case because of the way I'm just saying that there's no gap.
You said it turned out it didn't take that much time, but there wasn't anything. We have to assess it at the time the government made its decision to do a blanket withholding.
Correct. Okay. And I guess.
And the rationale given was one that the district court flatly rejected, just said that's not how FOIA works. Said that is not how FOIA works. You have the documents and you have to check them.
Well, it said that the volume of the documents was not enough to—
No, but it also said your unreasonable burden goes to search, not organizing the documents when you have them.
Well, as we've cited, I think it's Solar Sources and American Federation of Government Employees, which both stand for the proposition that, you know, where the search is, you know, the unreasonable burden question goes to search and review. And I think under Solar Sources, that case said that where this is going to be significantly unwieldy, as it was with our—
Right, and the district court rejected both. That you can't— first of all, the cases you cited involved search, and that your sense of unwieldy was off base for FOIA purposes. I mean, it takes a lot bigger numbers and a lot more hours under FOIA. You weren't in the neighborhood.
Well, the district court didn't pass on the number of hours. It passed on the volume. And it also, again, the case that it was relying on, Public Citizen, went to the lack of sufficiency of an explanation in the affidavits.
Do you have any case for the district court or one now that says the amount of documents and hours, all that was at issue here, something in that range at issue here? Post-search is done, not talking about unreasonable search, that just going through this many documents and what would take this many hours is too much of an obligation for an agency to have to execute under FOIA? Do you have any case that said that?
I don't have one specifically, no, Your Honor.
You didn't have any case?
We don't think, I mean.
Did you have anything close?
I don't think so.
You don't have any legal authority on point for your assertions?
Well, not specifically, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
My time is up. Does the court have any further questions?
I had one more. You also invoked FOIA Exemption 6.
Yes.
I don't know if you've abandoned that or not.
Well, we didn't, you know, we didn't appeal the order, so we're not, you know, disputing.
I mean, as to reasonableness.
As to reasonableness? That. Well, I mean, we noted it briefly in the brief. I mean, the fact is, on reasonableness, the court was looking to 6103 primarily. It wasn't looking to exemption six, and so we didn't think that needed that much addressing because the district court only needs one basis to find a reasonable basis. Mm-hmm. But as we said in our brief, we think under exemption six, you know, the rationale is essentially the same because the court
found under exemption six, you have to show that there would be a clearly unwarranted invasion of privacy. And your affidavits, again, at the relevant time here, invoking blanket exemption, said maybe, may, may, and may, which is not the standard for exemption six. That might work under 7C's privacy protection, but not exemption six, which requires would.
Correct.
So then it's not the same. So I don't know how you can just say if it's 6103, if we have a 6103 concern that also satisfies exemption six, given that exemption six has a very strict standard.
Would infringe. I'm sorry, just to be clear, we're saying that the district court's opinion found that for much the same reasons that our arguments under 6103 were not persuasive, they were for the same reasons not persuasive.
But that would be legal error then, plain legal error, which is always an abuse of discretion because exemption six requires a finding that there would be a privacy intrusion, not that there may or might be a privacy.
I guess I'm perhaps confused by your question. I mean, the district court found against us on that and we didn't appeal. So
I'm talking about, again, on the reasonableness of your legal position.
Well, I don't think that we needed to particularly defend on those grounds. I mean, the district court found that there was reasonableness under 6103.
I'm sorry, I thought you said your brief had raised it again. So
Well, correct. I mean, in the section where we address that very briefly in our brief, followed by our addressing the unreasonable burden standard, we said that the district court, you know, had sufficient grounds under 6103, and therefore, you know, you only need one reasonable basis.
Okay.
So. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rosenbaum, you are out of town, but you can have 2 minutes.
Uh-oh. Sorry for that delay. Because all of the four factors here weigh in favor of Professor Cuoca, we think this court should hold that she is both eligible for and entitled to fees and remand to the district court to award her the fees that she requested. And unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Any further questions? No, okay, well, thank you very much. The case is submitted.